My name is Nancy Graham. I am the current president of the Madison branch of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. We are approaching our 100th year, the oldest peace organization in the world. And we're going to be doing some exciting stuff next April, which is our 100th birthday. Jane Addams and 1,100 other women went to The Hague in April of 1915, hoping to persuade the leaders there to not continue with what they said was going to be a horrible war, which indeed it was. And we've been working on stopping wars ever since. If we weren't here, who knows how many more wars there would have been. So maybe we're partially successful. You can't know on that. Do check out our literature table by the door up there. In spite of all this noise, we are trying to tape it. I want to thank Bob Park in the corner there. He is audio taping for WIDE. It's a low power radio station, 99.1 on your dial, especially if you're on the west side. That's the best time place to get it. You can try it if you live on the east side. We also want to thank Russ Atto, standing up and back there. He is videotaping this event for WYOU Community TV. Thank you, Russ. I think that's all that I'm going to do. And Mary Sanderson, my co-worker, is going to introduce the speakers. Thank you all.
Welcome everybody. Oops, it's tricky. I am going to introduce our three speakers. We have Suzanne Bradley, and Mary Summers, and David Wanish. I'll start with Sue. After she speaks, I'll introduce the others with a little more detail. And I put papers on the table so that you can write down questions you may have and not have to forget them, because when we're finished, we'll have a regular conversation with everybody. Sue comes from an activist family. After growing up in Southern Colorado, she worked as a young teacher in the ghettos of Toledo. With her new husband,
Charles.
She worked on the Crow Reservation in Montana during 8 years of bringing the Crow language back into the schools there. Since moving to her farm near Portage in the late 70s, Sue has followed her passion for people and the environment as a home gardener, public school ED teacher, teacher of adults with disabilities, school board member, and curious traveler. Currently, Sue serves on the Columbia County Board, bringing an alternate point of view to many issues there. Madison Wolf is pleased to present Sue and David's reflections on the Witness for Peace Roots of Migration delegation they went on to Mexico last February. I'm going to turn it over to Sue now.
An alternative point of view, that's an interesting thought. Anyway, David and I went in February to Oaxaca, Mexico, and we went with a group called Witness for Peace. And in case there's anybody here who doesn't know about Witness for Peace, it's an organization that started in the 80s in Nicaragua. There was a need to accompany people during the time of the Contras and keep them safe. And Witness for Peace since then has expanded what they do. And they now have many, many delegations that go to places to learn about the effect of our foreign policy on various things. And then the idea is that we come back to this country and we come and talk to groups like this one, and hopefully we do something political to make change. In going on a Witness for Peace trip, it's more than just going somewhere and soaking things up. They do a lot of instructing also. We had sessions on globalization. We had sessions on many other things, and including power and privilege. For example, we come down there, North Americans, and we need to realize that we come from being the most powerful country in the world, most powerful people, and also the most privileged, and what it's like for other people that don't have that. I'm going to talk a little bit about migration. And I have to talk about NAFTA, because NAFTA is what led to all the migration, or a lot of the migration that we've seen from Mexico. When NAFTA came into being 20 years ago under President Clinton, it was done on fast track, which meant that it was voted through without any changes, and it was with great promise. It was going to increase jobs in all three countries, Canada, Mexico, and the United States. It was going to cut down on poverty. It was going to increase investment, and it was going to be great for the environment. Well, it's been a pretty dismal failure in a lot of ways. If we look at what it did in terms of poverty in Mexico, and this is the main reason for the incredible migration that we've seen, Mexico under NAFTA was no longer able to put a tariff to protect their corn. And because they couldn't do that, then we flooded, our American markets flooded Mexico with our corn, Arthur Daniels Midland and Cargill. And so about 2 million Mexican farmers went out of work. And so then they migrated looking for jobs, and they either went to Mexico City, they went to the sweatshops that were now forming on the border, and then a lot of them came north to our country. So that was one of the things. But it also affected us a lot too, because hundreds of thousands of American workers were thrown out of work because our businesses that were looking for cheap labor moved to Mexico and formed those sweatshops of terrible conditions and all. And it took jobs away from our rather most unskilled sort of workers, kids with high school diplomas that are now competing for fewer jobs. And you need to know that when it went to Mexico, those jobs, that's not a stopping place for those jobs. They now are going on to places like China and then on to Vietnam, where the jobs are the cheapest of all. And the sweatshops are pretty terrible, maquiladoras, where people have terrible working conditions. It wasn't a focus of our trip, but I need to say something a little bit about CAFTA, because the Central America Free Trade Agreement that came into effect in 2006 followed on NAFTA and did the same sort of thing. Same sort of promises, and for example, one of the results of that was in El Salvador, where 71% of the people out in the rural areas are unemployed now. I need also to mention the recent migration of all the children, because there's a lot of misinformation out there about why they're coming. There's incredible gangs down in El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras and some in Mexico. And these gangs started in the time of when we were supporting the dictatorships in the 70s, and they came from the United States and they've grown down there, and they're now targeting children. Now, President Obama's solution for this is to deport the kids even faster and also to increase border patrols, and he's really doing nothing to make conditions better down there for the families and all. But it really burns me, because I heard on the radio someone say they obviously don't love their children. Well, they're desperately looking for some kind of a life for their children. Well, in going to Mexico, we didn't just go down there to say, oh, what can we do about all this? We also went down there to see what the Mexicans themselves are doing to make lives better for the people there. And we visited a place called CEDECOM, which is the Center for Integral Campesino Development of the Mixteca. The Mixteca are the biggest indigenous group in Mexico, and they live in the state of Oaxaca. And now, in many places, there are ghost villages because so many of those people have migrated to the U.S. Ghost villages means that there may be a few old people, a few disabled people, and a few children. So we visited this place that is trying to get small-scale farming going, and they're experiencing quite a bit of success. They have 17 communities so far and 119 families that they're working with. And they have some goals. They want to protect the environment. They want to restore eroded soil. They want to foster sustainability for the food production. And in working with these farmers, they want to stop youth from wanting to migrate. And they've been pretty successful. It's really pretty exciting to see. Now, in Mexico, they have to cope with climate change, major. It's either drought or torrential rain. And so they're trying to bring in some old methods of farming that can withstand terrible conditions. They're not doing GMO corn. They're saving their own seed, and they're planting a lot of seed that will thrive in this sort of a condition. They're doing interesting things with water, a lot of drip irrigation, and then also a lot of ditches irrigation. They're also reforesting. They have about 40 million trees that they've planted, so there's a lot going on there. In doing all this, they're not just doing that, but they're also trying to restore the culture. So these people really feel a strong sense of commitment to that area. So that was pretty exciting to see. Well, I need to tell you a little bit about some of the migrants that we talked to. I'll start with a guy named Charlie. And Charlie was born in Mexico, but as a baby, he went with his mother north to the United States. He was just a baby, and his mother and his father were having some difficult times, so they went north. And he has actually been deported about five times and has gone back and forth a number of times. But at one point, when he was coming back over, his mother had legal status, but he did not. He and his sister were coming, and they had to go in trunks of cars to get over the border, and they had to sneak through culverts and tunnels and all. And at one point, he lost his sister's hand, and he never saw her again. So a lot of sadness in all these stories. In the United States, he was married, and he had two children, and his wife and he were having some difficulties. So he thought the person coming to the house was bringing some papers so he could have joint custody, but his wife actually was getting him deported. And he told us, he went back to Mexico then, and he set up a life for himself on some his grandfather's land. And he told us, he said, I'm doing this because I want to convince an American judge that I can have my kids part-time. And I thought, oh my, that'll never happen. A couple other people that we got to know, one is Mario, who came down in 2002. He came with a coyote at that time that cost $1,000. And now to get a coyote costs about $5,000. And when you think of poor people all rounding up money to do this, it's pretty incredible. He had many, many jobs, and he found life very, very stressful. In fact, at one time he was working from 7 in the morning till 3 in the morning. So you figure that out, he had about 4 hours of sleep. But in the process on Facebook, he met a woman from Mexico and went back to Mexico, and he's now part of a weaving co-op and is pretty happy with his life. And then Andres, who came north, went to high school in the U.S., but then could not go to a community college. He was not allowed to go. Eventually got deported, and then went back and forth a number of times like people tend to do, and then he's back in Mexico, where he's hoping to be an English teacher. And he said to us, the biggest sacrifice is to leave your family. Now, while we were there, we had the great opportunity to stay in an Indian village. And there, we got to know a group of women that formed a cooperative, a weaving cooperative. This whole village was a weaving group. And these were very interesting women because they're so determined. I did bring some things to show. I'm hoping to get the surf store to sell these. They're rugs that they make, and I just think they're so beautiful. So we'll see. It seems to be a complicated process to get started, but I guess once you get there, it'll be good. But this group of women, they started about 16 years ago, and first they had all sorts of problems. You know, the men said, oh my, you know, these women are uppity, and it's not okay in our culture and so forth. They survived that one. They survived some political people that wanted them to help with their politics. And finally, there was a woman's organization that came in and helped them get going. And this group of women not only does weaving and all that, but they also have projects to make life better in their pueblo. They started an environmental stove company based on a stove that came down from the state of Oregon. And these stoves use less wood, make less smoke, and they marketed those. They started recycling very simple ways. And they also decided to start a reforestation thing there. They thought, well, we'll plant 30 trees or so. And the people were so interested in this, they showed up, and there were 600 trees that people wanted to plant. They also do a lot with older women, and they do a lot with health. So that's my part of the presentation. I did bring a little handout on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because if you think NAFTA's bad, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is really bad. And Public Citizen has a wonderful website, and I thought if anybody's interested in writing a letter, that I would sort of cut down on the information you'd have to go through, and then you would know what to say. Obama would like to do it fast track this November, and we need to make sure that people are in line. Of course, our Senator Ron Johnson thinks it's just the best thing in the world, but I have some hope for Tammy that maybe she doesn't. So anyway, that's my part of the presentation.
Thank you very much. Mary Summers and her husband Andy Summers, who's sitting at the end of the table, began to spend 6 months in winter in Tucson 5 years ago, where she volunteers as a nurse with a humanitarian group called No More Deaths. So Mary brings direct human experiences from the border. She teaches English to mothers in the Head Start program there, and she's a member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in Tucson. We call it WILF. She lives 6 months in Madison as well, where she's a member of the Madison branch of WILF, and she's a member, an active member, of Madison Arkatau Sister City Project. So here's Mary Summers for you all.
Thank you. Thank you for coming tonight. Can you hear me?
Yep.
And thank you to the WILF group for giving this opportunity to not tell my stories, but to be able to tell the stories of the people that I meet when I'm working on the border. Tucson is 70 miles from the border. And what I do is drive down to the border, park my car, walk over to Mexico, to the city of Nogales, where the U.S. government is deporting people. And I want to tell you their stories, because they're probably not the faces of the people that you think are being deported. Maybe they are, but they weren't for me. I'm going to start with Ricky. Ricky was born in Mexico. When he was 3 weeks old, his mother brought him to the United States. For most of his young life, he did not know that he was not a citizen. When he was a young teenager, in fact, he went over to Mexico, and at that time, they asked, when you crossed, are you a citizen? And he said yes. And when he was deported at the age of 32, they brought that up to him. And they said that you lied. And he said, no, I didn't lie. I did not know that I wasn't a citizen at that time. Well, of course, he did find it out as things started to change in our country. And he became older and needed to want to do things. But he married a U.S. citizen. At the time of his deportation, they were separated, but he had an 8-year-old daughter. He was a carpenter. He had his own business. He lived in his own home. And one night, he looked outside the window and saw that someone was stealing his car. So he called the police. 3 years later, that still brings tears to me, as he told this story to me. The police came in. I don't know what happened to the car, but they deported him. He said, can I take a suitcase along and bring some things with me? And they said no. They took him right out of his house. May I call an attorney? No. He ended up on the border. They walk you, what the Border Patrol does, they walk you up to the border and say, walk over. He ends up in Nogales, a community he's not familiar with. He does not speak their language. Spanish is his second language. He speaks English as well as I do. He's lost, and he's got an 8-year-old daughter, his house, his business in Nogales. But he has a good record. He still is not considered a criminal because he did not cross the border on his own. He was brought by his mother as a child. So he does not want to cross through the desert illegally, because then he will not be able to ever apply for citizenship. So he's on the side of the border, selling used clothes, trying to find someone to talk to him, and after 2 months of being there, he hears me outside the Commodore, which is the place the Jesuits run, where people who are deported can come and eat. And he hears me speaking English, and he comes over and speaks to me. And I said to him, after a very short time, has anyone ever documented your story? And he said, no. And I said, I will do that for you now. And we sat down, and he told me his story. His mother didn't understand the significance, because back in 1980, there were no walls. You could go back and forth. She didn't see any difference of having the child in the United States and moving to Mexico or being in Mexico. She lived in a city that didn't have a wall down the middle of it like it does now. So Ricky is still waiting, as far as I know, to try to get back to the United States. Now, he could go in another part of Mexico and probably find a better job, but he wants to see his daughter. There are two attorneys now who are on the border with the ACLU who are trying to help people like Ricky. But at that time, 3 years ago, when I came back to Tucson, I did talk to an attorney. I refiled the report with no more deaths. I filed it with the ACLU. And I went to talk to an attorney who does work with people who are deported. And she told me, in her 20 years of working with people who are deported, she's been able to bring 7 back. Then I'm going to tell you about a woman who was pregnant, almost ready to deliver her baby. And she did not want to have the baby, apparently, in the United States. They had 2 children. Her husband took one of the children and crossed back into Mexico. She took another child. She was trying not to look too conspicuous, because when you're moving back, you're bringing your belongings with you, as many as you can, which is a big sign for the Border Patrol. They not only want to get you to be a criminal as you cross, but as you go back to your country. So someone from the Border Patrol saw her and said, I know where you can cross, opened up a hole in a fence. And as she went through, he apprehended her. When I was in Nogales, we heard that in the woman's shelter, there was a woman about to deliver a baby. So another nurse and I went over to see her, and we asked her if she was arrested. She said, no, she wasn't arrested. But she was held for 12 hours with just a little bit of water. We said, well, did you ever sign anything? Well, yes, she signed something. She didn't know what she signed. Well, she will not be able to try to get back into the border. I don't know what she signed, but she probably signed something saying that she would never return again. So this is what the border now looks like compared to how it looked like in the 80s. In 1982, you could cross back and forth with absolutely no problems. And here's where I might differ a little bit with Sue, because I thought I heard her say that NAFTA was going to make the people, we wanted the people in Mexico not to be poor anymore. The people who worked along the border knew that wasn't going to happen. Because in 1994, January 1st, Bill Clinton signed NAFTA. 4 months later, the walls started to go up in Nogales. They were that closely connected, because that wall is not just about not letting people into the United States, it's keeping poor people in Mexico. In order for NAFTA to work for these corporations, poor people must stay poor. They must work for 1/10 of the wage that they used to make in the United States. So what happened? Doris Messner said at a Senate hearing after NAFTA and when the walls were being put up, we knew, We know that NAFTA will bring more crossers, but we're leaving the part of the desert open that they will not want to go through. They'll try and they'll stop. What she meant was they'll die, and enough people will die and they will stop crossing because it's a very treacherous part of the desert. But these families were already settled in the United States. Some of them were working and they would go back to their communities, and now they had to tell the women and children, I can't come back anymore. It's too dangerous. I can't get back. You will have to bring the children to me. This crossing of children started a long time ago. Women and children crossing into the desert and dying. Joselina, both her mother and father, who were from El Salvador, called and said, bring your little brother to the United States. They came with a coyote. Joselina drank water that made her sick. So a coyote brought the little boy. Joselina died in the desert. Some went from No More Deaths, found the body. Anyway, Doris Messner, who was over immigration, testified that they understood what was going to happen. I mean, it was the policy, I call it a policy of death. And people who had families in the United States that were being deported, of course they're going to try to cross back. These walls and these policies are tearing families apart. People who worked in the United States for low-paying jobs before NAFTA, we wanted the people from Mexico to come and work in these low-paying jobs. And now they were going to go back into Mexico for the same job? Of course not. They were going to find something else, and when they're deported, they want to come back to their families. Now I'm going to tell you about Robert. Robert drove a van for a fancy hotel to amusement park. He lived in the United States for 25 years and his children were citizens. He and his wife were not. His mother was sick. He wanted to see her. This story you hear over and over. I went home to see my mother. He didn't understand how difficult it would be to come back. He was apprehensive. He stayed with his mother for 2 months, came back through the desert, was deported. It was at a time when the United States decided Nogales is a good place to deport people, better than Texas. They're getting killed over in Texas. They're getting a lot of support. There's a lot of border communities helping them. Let's just start deporting people through the Tucson sector. So all of a sudden at the Comador, where we had 60 to 80 people to feed, we had 120, two lines. And the holding places to hold the migrants, Robert told me he was put into a room, very warm. It said holds 40, 120 people. He was diabetic. They took his medicine away. People stood on his feet. When I saw him, his feet were swollen. He would not let me use his name in a documentation and his address because he was afraid his wife would be deported. And what he told me was over and over again, my daughter plays the violin, she's in sports, she gets A's. I don't want my children to leave their community. So he is prepared, because I do not see how he could ever cross through the desert. He was prepared to wait for his family to grow up and to go back to somewhere in Mexico. Juanita was driving home from work one night. She had two small children, 2 months old, 2 years old, and then she had a couple that were around 12. She had unpaid parking tickets. They stopped her and deported her. She said, can I call the babysitter, and they told her no. So when she saw me talking to Ricky and documenting his story, she was working between the Commodore and the bus station, She said, "Can I talk to you? Come to the bus station during my lunch hour," which I did. She had worked with a priest in Nogales, and she had her story all written out in English and in Spanish, just waiting for someone to give it to. She wants to know where her children are. This is another common theme of people who are deported. What happened to my children? If you ever saw the movie Innocent Voices, it shows that children were coming from El Salvador and these countries as children for some of the same reasons that you're seeing them today. The mothers know when they get to be 12 years old, they're going to have to make a choice and join a gang or join the army or join something. And they send their children, and then look, some of them are looking for them now. We met women who, they travel in groups. They take birth control before they leave because they know they're going to be raped along the way. They go through great risks to find their husbands, their fathers. This is a policy that tears families apart. And I just saw a report that came out fresh from El Salvador that did a study. They said 10% came from violence of the people that were leaving in El Salvador. They said that 41% were for families of these children who are coming. And we see, and 28%, I think, were for economic opportunity. When the children testified to Congress, more than half said they were coming for their families. Now, No More Deaths is a group, well, let me back up. This policy of dying in the desert, in 1995, there were no deaths. 96, there were 20. 99, there were 70. In 2000, there were over 100. After there started being over 100 deaths outside Tucson, a group of clergy got together and formed No More Deaths and started putting water out in the desert. The Border Patrol comes, we have it on tape, like those little cameras that you have, that you put to see if the deer hunters use. We put them out there looking over the water, and the Border Patrol come and they knock them over. But this group rolled up its sleeves and said, "What can we do?" And they were giving medical care. They were helping people make phone calls. They work to, we have a medical tent in the desert. And they try to put people's lives back together using the principles of civil initiative. Now, one other thing that happened is 2 years ago we started teaching English. And a year ago when I left, I said, if any of you have any problems, you can call me in Madison and I will find someone to help you. Because No More Deaths has also set up a legal clinic to try to stay deportations. And nobody called me, but when I came back last year, there were people who wanted to see me. Some woman who said, "I applied for citizenship 13 years ago when I married my husband and I haven't heard yet." I'm running out of time to tell you that sad story. I hope someday we do not have to do this work. But while the work has to be done, I feel very grateful and privileged that I can help show compassion to people when I meet them, haven't seen it for a long time. And when my government is doing policies that bring harm to people, I can stand up. And No More Deaths is a brave group. They're facing the empire. They're facing corporate greed. They're standing up and saying, we are going to help put people back together again. So I'm thankful, very thankful I can be a part of that, and I'm thankful I'm able to share my stories with you today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. David Wanish is here too. He also went in February with Witness for Peace to the south of Mexico, the same time Sue did. David, one moment please. David is a Green Bay native, sir, who studied at UW-Madison, served in the Peace Corps in Nepal, and is now a Catholic priest living and serving in Jefferson County, Wisconsin. He has traveled in Latin America, and tonight we'll hear what he and Sue learned when they participated in a Witness for Peace delegation last spring about the roots and consequences of the Mexican people's migration to the United States. Thank you very much for being here. We'll have a conversation afterwards. Don't go away if you don't have to.
Just a little more about Witness for Peace. There were about 20 participants in the delegation, and I had thought I was the only one from Wisconsin. To my delight, I learned that there was another who was not only from Wisconsin, but lived within, 50 miles of Madison. So Sue and I were able to meet a few times afterward. And now Witness for Peace, they really try to educate people who go on these trips into the near term, also the long term. And what are some of the far off reasons that bring people into the economic situation where they find themselves? Witness for Peace tried to give us that. So we had a session on global economics, and they mentioned the role of how one country sometimes is able to dominate another. You might think of a wrestling match, and how one wrestler can kind of make the other one in a vulnerable position. Maybe they give him a half Nelson, or a full Nelson, or a figure four, a leg lock. But I want to mention some of the economic positions that one country can get over another. So one is foreign debt. And it all begins with banks. I'm just going to kind of simplify. Two of the big financial institutions would be the World Bank and the IMF, International Monetary Fund. And they go back to post-World War II. And the Western countries wanted to make sure that another war like that would never happen again. And, well, what leads people to war? Well, it's fascism, communism. So these banks wanted to try to prevent that, that a country would choose a fascist form of government. So these banks were formed. And in the 60s, they accumulated a lot of money, especially after OPEC was formed. And the Arab nations had a lot of money from the oil, petroleum they were selling. Well, where do they put the money? Well, they put it in some of the big banks, the World Bank, the IMF. So now these banks have a lot of money, and they have to figure, what do we do with all this money? And the idea was, well, let's give it in loans to poor countries. And quite often it was Latin America. Mexico was one of the really big recipients of these loans. And for what was Mexico going to use them? Well, infrastructure, and also the Green Revolution. There was a lot of enthusiasm, optimism, that machinery used in agriculture, and chemicals used in agriculture, and new technology, and so on. So for these reasons, Mexico opened themselves and really took out a lot of loans. And then they had to pay them back. And for a while they could. They relied on their own petroleum income. Mexico has a lot of reserves of petroleum. And so for a while they were able to keep up paying back these big loans. But then there came a time when the price of oil dropped on the world market. This would be early 1980s. At the same time, the interest rate for these loans, they were paying back these loans, the interest rate went up. So these were the conditions for a perfect storm. And it was a crisis for Mexico. They were no longer able to pay back their debt. That's the full Nelson. That's the half Nelson. So now Mexico is very much, very vulnerable. And they were forced at this time to privatize and some of the subsidies to their farmers, they were told you can't do that anymore. The government cannot give that kind of assistance to the agricultural sector. And so this had the effect of really hurting a lot of the farming people, small farmers in Mexico. And this was the beginning of a big migration. So this would be late 1982, right around that time. But there was another financial institution that came to the rescue, and that was the International Monetary Fund. And they said, you can't pay back your debts. Well, here's what we'll do. We'll give you another loan. We'll give you another loan so you can pay back your other loans. But this one came with restrictions, came with conditions. And those conditions were more privatization. You will open up your sectors and privatize. And another one was dealing with trade. And I think this opened the door to NAFTA. NAFTA came 1984. I appreciate what Mary said, that it seemed that people knew in advance that migration would increase as a result of NAFTA. Actually, the official line was that migration would decrease because of NAFTA. It didn't turn out to be at all that way. And I think you said a few months after NAFTA took effect that the wall, and we were told on our trip that it was even a few years before NAFTA took effect, that there seemed to be some indication that the walls would be going up. So now NAFTA was a trade agreement to remove all trade barriers, remove tariffs, remove quotas, and so it would really open up trade. And it had the effect of, as I mentioned, hurting the agricultural sector. It should be said also that those involved, those who had input into the terms of NAFTA, were corporations. They really had the inside track. They had the voice in determining all the terms of NAFTA. The farmers, no voice. The laborers, no voice. It was the corporations. And so, you know, people sometimes look at NAFTA, and it's now 20 years later, and say, well, look at the net trade has gone up. But I think you need to look more closely at those figures. It's net trade to whom? To the wealthy, to the people who are already wealthy. Those who are poor and have been poor for a long time, they really haven't benefited. So NAFTA would be another one of those moves, the half Nelson, the figure four leg lock, one country dominating another. And timed very well with NAFTA. NAFTA went into effect January 1st, 1994. There was one other very major historical event that happened January 1st, 1994, and that was the indigenous armed uprising. The Indians from southern Mexico, mainly Oaxaca and Chiapas, they timed their uprising to begin on the very day that NAFTA took effect. One of the great fears of the Indians was that they would lose their land. Another one of the terms of NAFTA was that they called it Article 27. It was a change in the Mexican Constitution. By the way, how many changes were made in the Mexican Constitution as a result of NAFTA? People debate, but it's at least 120. 120 changes to the Mexican Constitution. How many changes to the United States Constitution in order to get NAFTA through? Zero. We would not tolerate, here in the United States, we wouldn't tolerate any change to our Constitution. Mexico, and then of course Canada. I don't think they made any changes to theirs either. But Article 27 of the Mexican Constitution allowed for the sale and privatization of land. Of land. Think of, what are the precious resources of any country? Well, land has to be one of the precious resources. Now this could be sold, and foreign entities could now buy Mexican land, including corporations. So why would foreign corporations want to buy Mexican land? Well, for mega projects. Again, part of the privatization, some of the structural adjustments that were very much in mind as the negotiators of NAFTA, mega projects would be another one of them. These would be mines. There's a lot of minerals in these Latin American countries, including southern Mexico. Hydroelectric dams. Dams produce electricity. Where are you going to get the electricity to operate these mines and other industries? Well, you get it from mega projects, hydroelectric dams, ports, canals, all these kinds of things. But now land could be sold. And indeed, we learned that one of the big conflicts that drive people away from Oaxaca in southern Mexico is conflicts over land. There used to be kind of a harmony between the various Indian communities in southern Mexico, but now you bring in that that element of greed and private property, and now there are conflicts over land. Much of it is, and I mentioned people want land, but also people are being driven off their land. Various kinds of disturbances are set up, people's lives are threatened, and the desire is to get them off the land, get these indigenous people off the land, so now the land can be used for mega projects. So that's a kind of the economic background. We had the opportunity to visit with Witness for Peace, a non-government agency called EDUCA, and they kind of gave us some of the background of Oaxaca. That's the particular place where we were. And Oaxaca is rich in resources, wind resources, water resources, that'd be for energy, lots of mineral resources, gold, silver, other things like that. Also, it's very rich in cultural resources. Oaxaca has more languages spoken than any other state in the Federation of Mexico because of all the Indians, many Indian languages. So a lot of resources. So the question is, with all these resources, why do people move? Why aren't they just happy to stay in Oaxaca? And the answer, of course, is poverty. Poverty and low income. What can, and other reasons were mentioned, Mary mentioned the family ties, people move for family ties. I want to focus on poverty, though. In a typical day, a worker in Oaxaca can earn, say, $5 up to $8, kind of an average. Now, they come to the United States, in 1 hour, they can earn $10, $12. So in 1 hour, they earn more than they do in a whole day. So there's a kind of a incentive to leave Oaxaca and migrate to the United States. There's also organized crime. Some of the previous speakers talked about that. I want to mention extortion. Really big problem. Someone could be a successful, very good, honest businessman, maybe providing for his or her family, maybe for his or her employees, but the business isn't going to do too well when the thugs come, organized crime, and say, you will hand over your wealth, hand over your money to me. If you don't, we'll do something bad to your daughter, do something to your wife. People's lives are threatened. And so after a while, people simply cannot live with that anymore, with that extortion. Another reason they leave, they go to a better place. Many of them go to the United States. I'm just going to finish a little more time. One last thing. We visited a migrant shelter in Oaxaca. And one thing you notice when you enter a migrant shelter, it's a lodge, it's a house to help migrants who are on their way. They're migrating from southern Mexico. Actually, most of them nowadays are from Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. They're coming from Central America, and these migrant shelters help them on their journey. So the first thing they do, they come in, and they see a map on the wall. And it shows them where they are, where Oaxaca is. And some of them think they've been traveling a long time. Maybe they started in Guatemala, whatever. Now they're in Oaxaca, they think the United States is really close, I'm almost there. They look at the map and they see Oaxaca is not that far from where they started. They've got a long way to go to get to the border of the United States. So part of what they do at these migrant shelters is give people useful information. You've got a long way to go. They also look at the map and they see the next migrant station, a place of help, refuge, so they can plan their way, go from one migrant station to another, to the next, and so on. So it's very helpful for them. These migrant shelters give them lodging 3 days and three nights. The one we visited, 3 days and three nights, gives them food. Many of them are in need of clothing. Guess what item of clothing is most important for them? Shoes. Shoes. Because when many of them are hiking, walking through the desert, their shoes actually melt in the hot sand and they get foot injuries, and that's the beginning. Once you get a foot injury, you're no longer able to keep up with the rest of your companions. They're going on, but you have to slow down, and now you're alone. Because of your foot injury, you're left behind, you're alone, and then you're vulnerable to predatory animals, mean people who are going to take advantage of you. So it all starts with foot injuries often. Not all the time, but often. So they're given shoes, and they're given medical care. Sometimes they need medical care. We heard about, Mary spoke of drinking bad water. That can really set people back. Stomach ailments and leg ailments. Their feet brush against all these cacti and other sharp plants. So they have need, and they're given medical help. When they arrive at the migrant shelter, they're given an interview. People ask them questions, and what's your name, what's your age, and they really try to pay attention to particular body markings. If someone has a scar, because this helps identify them uniquely, their individuality, their identity. If they have a scar, maybe they have dental fillings or something like that, or tattoos, that'll help identify them, because as they leave the migrant shelter, they go on, many of them disappear, never seen again. Sometimes their body is found. This will help kind of track them. At least they know, well, they stopped at this shelter in Oaxaca, and sometime after that, it just kind of helps track where these people are in their journey. They also give them advice. They say, many of them, one of the precious things they carry as they're on their journey is a little slip of paper with a phone number. They've got an aunt, an uncle, a brother, a sister in the United States. They keep that phone number so they can get in contact with them, make a phone call on the journey. Well, if they lose that, they're really in big trouble. So they keep that. And the migrant shelter will write down that phone number for them. In case they lose it, they can always call back the migrant shelter. And then they'll say, well, this is the phone number. So it's just kind of helping them in that way. But they advise people, never give anyone your phone number. Never give it to a stranger, because a stranger will use it, if the person's a criminal, they'll use it to blackmail the person. They'll call up the phone number, call their brother in Chicago, and say, you know Pedro? And the guy says, yeah. Well, I'm holding Pedro here. You have to give me $100, or we're gonna kill Pedro. And of course, the relative in Chicago is gonna send the $100, probably more like $1,000 or something more like that. I don't know the amount of money. But these migrant shelters really help people a lot on their journey. Maybe I'll finish there.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, David. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Sue. Now, it may be that you all have some questions. First, let's try questions for a few minutes, and then we'll welcome comments as well. I want to see first if anybody has any questions for any of the speakers.
I'm curious about the migrant shelters. Like, who, what organizations run them, or how are they?
The question is, who sponsors the migrant shelters?
I can speak about the one that we visited. It had its beginnings like 10 years ago in the Catholic Church. And I think there's a religious community in the Catholic Church called the Comboni, Sisters and Brothers and so on. And I think that's the particular community that funded this particular shelter. So I would say church groups often do.
Like humanitarian church, humanitarian groups. It's private.
Humanitarian.
Private.
And, yeah.
Private.
Maybe you know more about it?
No, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah. Yep, I would say humanitarian organizations.
But private is what you were asking, not government. Is that the kind of the question?
I mean, I
yeah, okay. Any other questions?
I guess I was interested in the shelters. How many are there, and are they
structured almost like the slaves, you know, getting underground.
Oh, if the shelter system is really organized throughout the country and if it's like an underground railroad?
Yeah. Yes. On the map, there was like a colored pin at each migrant shelter. 15 or 20, I'd say, were on the map. So there's about that many. And some of the people in our group made that connection that it's kind of like the Underground Railroad. And it is kind of like that in some ways. Someone had the idea, well, couldn't some helpful Americans just rent a bus and kind of bus people from one migrant shelter to the other? And the people there said, well, it's a good try, but it probably wouldn't work because there's no one to guarantee their safety as they're on the road from one migrant shelter to the next. So road safety would be an issue there.
Did you want to add anything to that?
Well, the shelters that I see in Nogales, because the Jesuits are very well established there, and they do a very good job. But they mainly also work with the Mexican consulate. But there was a little shelter called La Roca that a couple from El Salvador had that they just did on their own. And my sweet husband gave them $100 last year so they could be making phone calls back home. Because when they're deported, they take away their backpacks, their shoestrings, often their shoes, some of their clothes. These are broken down people, and this shelter was helping them get clothes, make phone calls, get ready to go home. I just received an email a week ago, I think I shared it with my group from Wilk, that the Mexican police went in and they abused 12 migrants that were in it and beat up the couple that was running it. And someone reported it, and the police came back and took everyone's pictures. And they said, if you report us again, we'll come back and kill you. And they are all now in hiding, and this shelter is no longer operating. So the shelters that are run by the religious organizations are most successful because the police respect them more.
Oh my goodness. Who has another question?
I have a comment.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Lisette Bonner and a friend of Sue and Charles. And I live in Mexico 7 months out of the year. And I would like to make a couple comments. First of all, the gangs that you hear about are largely exported from the United States, because a lot of the Hispanic gangs, especially on the West Coast, have served some time in prison. And the gangs are very, very active in the prison. And as soon as they get out, they get deported. And they take their gang stuff right back with them, especially to El Salvador. And when these migrants come from Central America through Mexico, and I'm very partial to Mexico, but it is a terrible, awful experience for them, because we think and hear about them coming through the desert, you know, when they cross into the States. But if you've read things like Enrique's Journey or other things, these kids are riding on the top of trains, a lot of them, to get through. Or by any other means. And as they come, these other countries are, people from other countries are many, many times molested and abused by the Mexicans who don't want them there. And I forgot, but anyway, getting through Mexico is an awful experience a lot of time. And my partner's Mexican, and he has never come with me to this country because he really has no reason to. Guess what? These people don't want to come here. This is not their burning desire to come to the United States. They're just trying to survive. They're trying to escape the poverty or the violence. And there's nothing that makes them want to leave their home, their pueblo, their language, and most of all, their family, and I should say their culture. That's the last thing they want to do, but they feel they have to, you know, for jobs or try to find some security. And the last thing I'd like to say is, Father talked about these loans that create a servitude to the IMF and the World Bank. If you're interested, read Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It's a wonderful story of a guy who worked, I can't remember if it was IMF or World Bank, but he would go in as an appraiser and bump up the amount of the loans this country should have to build their railroads and put in stations and so on. So these huge loans were created, and with the interest, of course, that the people could not pay back. And this guy got so sick of doing it, it was in Ecuador especially, that he quit and wrote about it.
What was the name of that
book? Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Thank you, Lisa.
Datsa. I'll ask everybody to start thinking, especially our speakers, before we say goodbye, we want to try to think of some suggestions of what people like us might be able to do in facing this terrible situation. What can we do? I don't know.
Okay, so I don't really have a question. I just want to put out a warning. There are two more trade agreements coming down, the transatlantic and the trans-Pacific, that are going to create the same sort of situation that is happening with the NAFTA agreement in Asia and in Europe. And both of those are attempting to be fast-tracked as well. And fortunately, we had enough information prior to them getting signed that we've been able to slow that down some. WILF is working very hard on that, and so are a number of other organizations. And we hope to have some information about that up on the WILF website, but there is stuff on the national WILF website about that. And seriously, that is another place where we need to stop these agreements in order to stop the corporations from completely taking control of the entire world at this point. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. I just would like to add that I did look at Public Citizen's website, and I got some information on what, in particular, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, would do. Is that working?
Put it close to your mouth.
Kiss it.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. I put some handouts over there on the table about what the Trans-Pacific Partnership would do, and this is from Public Citizen. You need to know that this has been going on for 5 years. They've been negotiating this, and it's been done in utter secrecy. Congress is not even allowed to know about it. And Public Citizen said, this is not a trade agreement. Out of 29 chapters, 5 of them are about trade. The rest of them are about massive corporate takeover.
Yep. And the harmonization of our local laws.
Thank you. So what to do? What to do?
Well, this is easy because No More Death studied this all last winter. What are we going to do? And, you know, there's a lot of things that would really work. I agree, they don't want to come. People do not want to leave their communities. If the corporations paid them decent wages that moved down there, they would be able to stay. If they got decent money, they wouldn't be wanting to come and work for minimum wage here. But after studying this for months, one of the things that we are working on in No More Deaths, first of all, is no more deportations. And since Obama had a executive order deferring deportations, we have been very successful with phone calls, when we know someone's being deported, to stop. They don't always work. But what worked for immigration reform and to help people during the wars in Latin America during the 80s was sanctuary. And many of the people who worked in the sanctuary movement, many of those priests are the ones that started No More Deaths. And they are now starting sanctuary for people who are being deported. Southside Presbyterian Church has someone in its church right now who's supposed to have been deported on Tuesday. And they're not
Madison?
Letting...
Madison or Tucson?
Tucson. Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson. And when the sanctuary movement spread, and many of you I know were involved in it, it not only helped the people, but it embarrassed Ronald Reagan, and he passed immigration reform. And one of the things that we're trying to do is start the sanctuary movement again, because you're not going to be getting immigration reform very soon, unless you do something really drastic. So stopping deportations, start a sanctuary. Those are my suggestions.
Thank you. Who else has a comment or a suggestion? And then we'll be able to say goodnight.
You know, I think one of the things we can do is find out what corporations are doing business south of the border and using the small amount of money as a way to, it's essentially, it's a slavery. And we cannot buy anything that's remotely connected to any of those businesses. I know there's software that you can get to find what to buy. You can scan it in any store. It's called Buycott, B-U-Y-C-O-T-T, Buycott. And
B-U-Y?
From my perspective, yes, we should not be buying a gosh darn thing that any business makes if they support this kind of behavior. And we can all do that. You don't have to have a software. Every organization here can make a list and we'll pass it around. And, that's relatively simple.
Thank you. Yeah. Anyone else would like to have a word?
The other thing you can do is not invest in the oil companies. Mexico is in the process, because of corruption and mismanagement, of selling their oil again. So Peña Nieto is up there talking about how it's going to benefit Mexico, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they are selling their oil resources. Don't invest in the oil companies.
Thank you.
Privatizing the oil. Pemex.
Pemex is privatizing again. I want to ask if someone here could speak to the idea and about what we can do, variety of suggestions, good ones. What about microloans to real people who are trying not to migrate? Is that something we should think about? Where would we start?
There's an organization right here in Madison that is a primary. Here you go.
Wouldn't you like to say something about micro lending?
Yeah, well,
sure.
Introduce yourself, please.
Okay, my name is Carlos Arenas, and you mentioned me for this topic because I used to be the director of an organization here in Madison that created a microfinance fund more than 20 years ago, originally in Nicaragua, and now work in other American countries. Originally, the name of the organization originally was the Wisconsin Cordillera Council on Nicaragua, and now it's Working Capital for Community Needs. There are several groups in town doing this type of work internationally, like WCCN, and also here in the state of Wisconsin, like Forward Community Investments, invested in the communities, so and groups that are more supporting and to put your money not in corporations, but in go back to the community.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Sue?
Go ahead. Put it over here again, please. Probably just yell.
Question for Carlos?
Carlos, I know how your program has expanded beyond Nicaragua. Are you doing that in Mexico? Do you know if WCCN has micro lending in Mexico?
No. Not at this moment.
Okay. Data. Announcements. Uh-huh. Before we say goodnight, we need to give you all a chance to make announcements if you have them.
Well, the 26th of August is the anniversary of women winning the vote. So if you want to have a party, the Wisconsin Women's Network is gathering at the Cooper's Tavern on the Square from 5 to 7. So it's a fundraiser for them. WILF is a member organization of the Women's Network. So please come if you can.
To celebrate Women's Equality Day. Anne.
One more thing. When I was in Cambridge recently, there was a group that had this discussion like this. And two Indian students stood up and said, hey, if you look at the way corporations plan, all their massive plans that they have, they plan on expanding 2% a year at least. Recently, it hasn't been expanding. And from their perspective, all we have to do is cut back on what we buy. Everybody, cut back on what you buy. And it will not expand. And their future plans that depend on this will suddenly be at risk. They figure, these Harvard Indian students figure, it takes 10 years before we see them start having severe problems. So if you want to do your bit, don't buy what you're thinking of buying next time, and instead make do with something else.
Okay, thank you very much. Mary will have the last word, and then we will say goodbye.
Well, it's an announcement, a kind of an announcement. I have two copies of El Salvador's Sister Cities perspective that I was asked to bring some copies. I only need two of them. And my husband has them if somebody would like them to see them.
Thanks to everyone.